You'd like to be making your way over to Genesis chapter 9. That's where we're going to begin our study here in just a minute. And as you're doing that, let me thank you for the invitation to be here. Pam and I have enjoyed being able to be with you these few days, renewing some friendships that we've had before. In fact, as Tony was talking, I was reminded of something I was thinking about earlier today. As a young adult, I remember being at Eastside in several Bible studies, and I guess Tony and Libby were newlyweds at that time, and I had several of those at their house, and just thinking about what a good time that was in my life, and how many good influences were around. So I appreciate him and all the good that he does here. I know you know that. And I hope that you do well. We have been tested for the past year. We have learned to be flexible in the past year. And I hope there's some good lessons for us in that. And so I hope that you do well as individuals and do well as a church as you continue on to do good in this area. Tonight, we're going to pick up with an idea somewhat that we looked at last night as to how God will begin themes very early in the Bible story, and He'll walk those through the entire Bible. And so this evening, I want us to think about Babylon, but we're going to begin back in Genesis chapter 9, where we have one of the oddest stories in the Bible. I don't know if you've ever thought about it or not. If you're like me, you've probably known this story most all your life, and we get to a certain comfort level with it, where we oftentimes don't realize just how strange it is. But yet, what we're finding here is that the people who are populating the earth have made a decision. They have decided that they are going to outdo God. That God has given them instructions, and instead of following those instructions, they're going to do things their own way. So let's look and see what's happened here. In Genesis chapter 9 and verse 7, as Noah and his family got off the ark, they had a command that should sound very familiar to us. God says in verse 7, "And you be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it." That's the exact same command that was given to Adam and Eve. And so at the very get-go of the creation, God gives this command. Now that He is recreated, as we looked at last night, He gives this command again. He says, "I want you scattering throughout the earth, and I want you to fill it up." But this group of people, and I don't know if it's every person on the face of the earth or just a big bunch of them or what, because God doesn't tell us. But whomever it is that's under consideration, they say, "We are not going to do that." In fact, they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." God said, "Scatter." They said, "We're staying." God said, "Populate." They said, "We're going to build a city, and we're going to stake our claim here, and we're going to build this tower." And if we translated this exactly like the language dictated, they would say, "We are going to build ourselves a tower whose head is in the heavens." In other words, they're going to rival God, or at least so they think. But one thing God is going to make very clear to them is that He will not be thwarted. Are you here in chapter 9? I want to notice a couple of verses with you here. If we look to what God is... I'm sorry, I meant chapter 11. Getting my passages mixed up here. Chapter 11, if you look at the Lord's words in verse 4, they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth." Then look at verse 5. "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built." You ever paid attention to that language? What did they say? They said, "We're going to build this tower that's head reaches into the heavens." And God says, "You know what I'm going to have to do? I'm going to have to come down so I can get a really good look at this little project that's going on." What they thought was so massive, God said, is so utterly small. And it continues on down in verse 7. Again, he's mimicking their language where they said, come, let us build a tower. In verse 7, he says, come, let us go down. And so what God is doing here is showing us, in rather ironic terms, that everything mankind thought they could do, He is telling us is so small in comparison to Him. So what happens then? We know the story. What stands out in this story, and as we still use kind of as a word today in English, is a word that means the confusion of languages. And so we find that the Lord dispersed them all over the face of the earth because they couldn't understand each other any longer. God said, if I leave these folks to their own devices, they're going to do whatever they want. Now, He's not feeling rivaled by that. But what He's saying is, they're going to keep coming up with these big ideas. They're going to keep coming up with these grand schemes of how they can get out of doing it. So He says, I'm just going to end that right now. I'm going to confuse their languages. And so here's where we have the beginning of the nations. In fact, if you back up to chapter 10, that's the lead-in. All of these nations of the earth, God pauses and He says, let me tell you how they got their start. It's when they tried to outdo me. But what I taught them is that they cannot. And so the name of this place was given the name Babel. Still our word today, isn't it? When we hear confused language, when there's things that maybe somebody's saying that's rather nonsensical, what do we say? What are they babbling about? Well, you've got the origin of that word here. But here's a very interesting thing. What is translated here in Genesis 11 as Babel, everywhere else in the Old Testament is translated Babylon. And so once we get past chapter 11, when we find this word every time, it's going to be Babylon. There's a reason for that. That's because God is starting an idea here that's going to continue all the way through the Bible. And what it's going to come to represent is a nation in rebellion against God. So here at the Tower of Babel, these people rebel against God. They say, we refuse to separate and we'll show you. God says, no, somebody's going to be shunned, but it's not me. Now, we leave that and let's go to the other end of the Bible. So we've got Babel in Genesis. Then when we make our way to the book of Revelation, what are we going to find John talking about? Well, let's read a little bit here and see. So we go to chapter 17 of the book of Revelation. And it says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers of earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names. And it had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery. Now look at what was written here. Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Book of Revelation gives us all kinds of pictures. And we have to try to fine-tune our minds to imagine what John is describing. So I want you to try to picture this lady. Have you ever seen a woman who maybe is a beautiful woman, but what she's done is she's tried to array herself with all kinds of beauty implements? So maybe she's got on the false eyelashes, and maybe she's got rings on every finger, and 5 or 6 bracelets on her arm, and 5 or 6 necklaces hanging down, whereas any one of those might complement her beauty, all of them taken together really detract. I believe that's what John is showing us here. from a distance, you might say this woman was gorgeous. But the closer you get, you begin to realize that she's just tried to put on airs. And even as you get closer than that, you realize what a corrupt woman she is. And here, on her forehead, is the name Babylon. The great empire of Babylon had ceased long ago when this was written. So obviously it's not that John's talking about, but it's my belief that John has the Roman Empire under consideration, and what has it become? It's become the Babylon. Genesis chapter 11, rebellion against God. Revelation, rebellion against God. An empire that has grown haughty, and all interspersed between, we have many, many references to Babylon. And so what do we find? We find that the word Babylon, while it was a literal place, also became a highly symbolic place. And when the name Babylon is mentioned, it's a government that's grown drunk on its own power. A government that believes it can build a city and a tower with its head in the sky. Or a city or an empire that believes it dictates what's right and what's wrong. We also find that it's a refusal to recognize Jehovah God as supreme, typically full of all kinds of pagan idolatry, whether that is the Babylon that bore that name or the other nations that bore it symbolically. They're filled with all of these idolatrous worships. Religion is still a part of the empire, but it's absconded. And it's taken to increase the power of the government. What we would call it today is state religion. It's religion, all right, but it's controlled by the government. And we also find that typically there's going to be a persecution of the Lord's people within this place. For those who are saying, we want to stay righteous, we want to do what God says, ultimately, those people are going to fall in a bad light. Now, let me say this. When you study world history, for a nation of any size, give it long enough, and it becomes Babylon. You can just look through world history, and maybe here's a nation that started out very small, but it grows, and it develops maybe into an empire status. You allow that to last long enough, and you're going to find, in some way, shape, or form, all of these things taking place. So how do godly people behave when that's the case? When they're living in this beastly place, this nation that in Revelation language has put on the clothing of the beast, how do the people of God behave themselves? Aren't we fortunate that God's answered that question? Because He recorded the stories of three young men who live in the real Babylon, the one that bore that name. And He provides a very lengthy section within the book of Daniel that's going to show us how these three young men behave themselves. I'm going to have the passages on the screen. If you need to follow along in your Bibles, it's Daniel chapter 3, where we'll be looking. And I want us to follow along and see what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did when they faced this situation. So let's take a look at this. As we look in Daniel chapter 3, it says, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Let's stop there. Do you remember anywhere in the Bible where a very tall structure was set up on a plain? I hope so, because we referenced it 5 minutes ago. I am convinced that what God is doing is He's giving us a big elbow to the ribs and saying, think Tower of Babel. That tower with its head in the clouds now is being represented by an idol whose head is in the clouds, by a king who had already come into contact with Jehovah but suffered terribly from short-term memory loss and is now making himself the leader, the religious leader. So he sets this up. Verse 2. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then we have a repeat. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You know what that's saying? Everybody who was anybody was there. All of the officials, all of the government offices represented, everybody in all of the departments, they were there. And they're ready to comply with the king. And so the king has said, you're going to bow down to me. I'm commandeering the religion. I'm going to be your God. So what happens now? Well, the people are very readily going to obey that. Let's look at verse 4. It says, the herald proclaimed aloud, you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages. By the way, the last time we read that was in Genesis chapter 10. That being brought out of the people and the nations and the languages. So he said, you are commanded that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. Here we go again. Therefore, as soon as the people heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You know where else you worshiped where an orchestra was playing? That was the Lord's temple in Jerusalem. When the temple was in its heyday, when the people were behaving, there were Levites whose job was to play in the orchestra when worship was being conducted. And so what our writer here is doing is saying, look at what the king's doing. He's commandeering all of these things. Who's to worship God? People of every tribe, nation, and language. Who's worshiping Nebuchadnezzar? People of every tribe, nation, and language. How are they worshiping? With all the pomp and circumstance that was due Jehovah God, and they have no qualms about it whatsoever. Because for them, this was not a big deal. Worship His image, worship Asherah, worship Baal, whomever, wherever, just as long as you're worshiping. And so Nebuchadnezzar is using this for a power grab. By the way, did you notice what happens if you don't? Just in case, there's this raging fire over here, and he says, by the way, you'll be in there if you don't worship me. Just in case you have any ideas. And there were three young men who did have some ideas. And so we find that there were certain Jews. These are the people of Nebuchadnezzar reporting to him. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Remember what the beast always does? The beast rages at those that will not comply. Those who take a stand against him. And here are these three young Jews who are doing exactly that, because what Nebuchadnezzar is doing is saying to violate the very first commandment. So what happens? Well, the king is furious, the text tells us. And it says his face changed toward them. In other words, he is a very unhappy guy. And so he brings them in. And he says in verse 14, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, here we go again, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into the fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Does that sound familiar? Do you remember a Babylon that Israel faced? In fact, they were slaves there in Egypt. And when Moses goes before Pharaoh and he gives them the message of Pharaoh, or message of the Lord, Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord that I should serve him?" Nebuchadnezzar saying almost the exact same thing. Pharaoh had set up a state religion. Nebuchadnezzar has set up a state religion. Let's look and see what these young men do. The three answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." I want you to listen to their answer. Three important things. First of all, they answer him respectfully. "O king." They don't use any kind of insulting language. In fact, just the opposite. These young men, though they are in defiance of the king, are using very honorable language. However, they tell the king very resolutely, "We are not going to do this. You have asked us to comply with something that we will not comply with." And we might follow that then with a third idea, that they were unswerving. They said, "We trust that God can save us. But even if he doesn't, we're not turning. We're not changing. He's going to deliver us." They knew one way or the other, it might be in this life or the life to come. But they say, "Even if this takes us to death, we're not going to do it." You know, there's a lot of folks who say that kind of thing. That say, "I'm going to stand with God no matter what until the punishment is in sight." And suddenly that resolve melts away. And that confession of faith becomes very much a swerving. And they give in. But not these three young men. These three young men stand up to the beast. They say, "We are not going to commit this sin." And you recall that God did save them. And you'll recall, yet once again, Nebuchadnezzar is forced to confess who the true God is and honor these three young men. With that being said, I do not want to pretend that I'm a prophet. And I sure don't want to come across as a doom and gloom guy. But you and I well know our culture is not heading in the right direction. Here's the thing. 24-hour news is one of the biggest curses ever inflicted on mankind. Because it can sometimes make us think that things that are not that big are that big. And I think on occasion, we may have the tendency to think things are a whole lot worse than they really are because it's just pounded in our head hour after hour. And there are folks who sit around with that 24-hour news going 24 hours. That's a bad idea. With that said, there is no doubt that we're heading in the wrong direction. When we are having what are supposed to be legitimate conversations on allowing four-year-olds to choose their gender, we're not going in the right direction. When we start talking about the idea that there is no real standard when it comes to sexuality, we're going in the wrong direction. And so you look at the four institutions that I've got represented on the screen. Frightening stories coming out of universities, where professors are being fired for using the wrong pronoun. Other times, you've got social media that's banning people on occasion for taking a stand for right. Within the halls of our own government, we have debated, and it has become law, that you marry whomever you want. There's no standard there. And our friends in Hollywood have cheerleaded it the entire way. I'm glad I live in the United States. I wouldn't trade it for anything on this earth as far as citizenship is concerned. But we have to understand that whether this is next month or whether this is 50 years down the road, given long enough, a nation is going to put on the clothing of the beast. And what you and I have to do is to be ready for that. Hopefully it won't come. Hopefully all of us are going to live our lives in freedom and peace, and we're going to enjoy this country and the life that we have come to appreciate here. But we've got to be ready in case that doesn't last. So what do we do? Good thing is God's told us how to behave. God's told us how. And He's done this in a rather unusual way. We're going over to the writings of Peter in 1 Peter chapter 5. And as Peter is beginning to wrap up his letter here, he says, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings." The city and the empire of Babylon have not been around for centuries by this point. So is Peter just mixed up? Does he just get it wrong and say, "Well, I think I'm in Babylon, so I'm going to put Babylon"? Of course not. You know where Peter most likely is, and that's wrong. And so as he's writing, he's calling to mind all of these things you and I have talked about, that where throughout the Bible, Babylon has become the name to show a government that's feeding on itself, that's growing in power, that's trying to outdo God. And he's going to launch from that into a discussion of how you treat a government that's doing that very thing. And so he says, "Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as set by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor." You realize Peter is not far from being killed, pretty much by the emperor's command. And yet, what does he say? He says, "Here I am in Babylon, and my words to you are, you be subject to the institutions of man, and you honor the emperor." Now, does the emperor get the same acknowledgement as everybody else? No. He says, "What I want you to do is to love the brotherhood. And by all means, fear God. But the respect that you would give to everybody outside of your brethren and God, you give the emperor that same respect. You honor everyone, including him." We do well to pay attention to that. Because what Peter is saying, and this is a section that he's been dealing with, where he's saying there are times when the people of God are going to be in situations where there's somebody who's not very godly in authority. And so he says to wives who are married to non-Christian husbands, you be subject to them. Your attitude may very well save them. And he tells servants, slaves, you may have an unchristian master, you be subject to him. You do not misbehave. And he says to citizens who live in Babylon, you be subject to the emperor. So what does that mean for you and me? I'm convinced that Peter is saying to these people in a positive way the idea of, do not even think about rebelling against this leadership. And in no way diminish the emperor. In other words, he's saying you are not to become some little group of subversives out here where you're going around committing what we would call today domestic terrorism to show the emperor that he can't tell you what to do. It's just the opposite of that. Aren't we fortunate in our country that God has blessed us with the ability to have a voice in who's leading us? Yet, the principle still applies. And I'm convinced if the people of Peter's day were told, you are not to rebel and you are not to diminish your leaders, the same thing applies to us. We consider it almost an American right to run down our leadership, don't we? We consider it almost a privilege that we can say virtually anything about any leader and feel pretty good about it. I want us of the household of God to reconsider that. Whomever occupies the White House, whomever occupies the halls of Congress, the chamber of the Supreme Court, whomever is sitting in the governor's mansion, whomever is in the state legislature, whomever is mayor, city council, God says you show them honor. You don't have to agree. And I think there's room for that. That you can state disagreements in a gentlemanly way. And if somebody's going in a direction that you don't like the way they're going, you've got the right as a citizen to vote. But what we do not have the right to do is to begin hurling all of these things at those people that we do not care for because of their politics. There was a young man several years ago now, we just walked in one night to the Gooch Lane building. And he said, I need to study. And so we went back to my office and we studied for about an hour. I took him to Romans chapter 6 and we looked at what Paul said about faith and baptism. And he says, I'm ready. I said, well, tell me what you're ready to do. And he told me. And that very evening he was baptized. And he's had kind of a rocky road, but he's still hanging in there. But I'll never forget one of the things he said to me. He said, I just can't understand why all of these Christians have so much politics on their Facebook page. Here was a young man who was new to Christ, and his initial observations were very telling. That when someone can look at something that represents me and it's filled with vitriol and hatred and making fun, I'm not sure I'm standing with the Apostle Peter when he says, you show honor to the emperor. I am speaking to myself here. I want you to know that. Because when you talk government for 31 years, you tend to end up with a few political opinions. But you have to be careful. You have to make sure that when someone knows you, what stands out is the love you have for Jesus Christ and the honor you're giving to everyone, including the people who are in power. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. That's what the Apostle Peter commanded the Christians of the first century who lived under that corrupt Roman Empire. And that's what God commands of 21st century Christians today. We need to be careful. We need to make sure that we're honored as God has said. We need to also understand that we must be resolute. When we think about the stand we've taken for Christ, that's not impacted. Must not be impacted by anything that's going on these shifting sands of the earth. Listen to what Jesus told as he wrote to these churches in the beginning part of the book of Revelation. I've chosen three different passages here. We're not going to fill in the details. But look at what's in yellow. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, yet you hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. Only hold fast what you have until I come. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. I think we're getting a picture. Given long enough, every nation is going to put on the garments of the beast. And when the garments of the beast are put on, they're going to come after the people of God. That's just the way it is. And so Jesus does not offer a real detailed explanation. Now, this is why I'm letting it go on. I want you to understand this. Instead, what he says is, look, it's rough. You hang on. With everything you've got, you hold on. That takes strength. That takes resolve. And quite honestly, I'm not sure that 21st century American Christians are quite ready for this challenge yet. That we have become so lax because we are used to not only our government allowing, but condoning religion. We oftentimes talk about how terrible the government is, but yet, at least for the moment, we get tax write-offs for our contributions. Churches don't have to pay taxes. We've got In God We Trust on our currency. I mean, there are all kinds of vestiges of godliness that are still around where our government is endorsing it. But yet we realize that if that day does come when it's taken away, that's going to make zero difference for us. We're going to stay firm. And that means during these times of peace, we got to be getting it together. We've got to make sure that we are preparing ourselves for that day to come. And so that means, let's don't get tangled up in all the things of this earth. I can assure you, there is no political party that's going to save us. You ever catch yourself doing that? Whatever party you're a member of, if you are, the other party's in power, and you think, man, if we just hang on for 4 more years, 2 more years, we can vote this party in power and things are going to be so much better. Take a look at American history. And what you're going to find is that there may be some nominal movements one way or the other, but we rarely find a time when there's been this great spiritual renaissance. And some party is saying we're bringing honesty and integrity and there's not going to be any corruption. None of that. Vote. By all means, if you want to vote, I believe that's a privilege God has given to us. Don't vote if you don't think that's the case. But whatever, don't think a political party is going to say. And I might add with that, we need to make sure we're being very careful with our media, with our entertainment. The people who are on our screens are actors. That's their claim to fame. But yet, many of them believe they now have the right to tell you and I how we should vote, what we should believe in, what we should believe against. We need to leave all of that alone. And if you've got 24-hour news on 24 hours a day, turn it off. You'll be a lot happier person tomorrow if you'll do that. These are things that are testing that resolution. These are things that may not appear to be a very big deal, but they're kind of poking at us. And they're saying, look, you need to reconsider. You need to rethink your stance. Do you really need to be that strong on this particular issue? We must be careful about that. And might I add also that let's make sure we're not becoming champions of state religion. We think, well, there is no Church of America, and that's right. But there can be religions that are not church-affiliated. I look in our times at the modern environmental movement, and that's exactly what it is. I am a conservationist through and through. You can ask my wife. I fuss every time a tree is cut down in Limestone County. Every time they're pushing them away to build something. I don't like that. But that's a lot different than the modern environmental movement where the earth has been made God. And the science book has been made the Holy Scriptures. We've got to be careful of that kind of thing. And we've got to be careful of that with our kids. Because those kinds of things are being fed even through the cartoons they watch. And you may have seen some stories this week along that line. We've got to be very, very careful that we are not allowing our resolute determination to stay faithful to God to be diminished bit by bit by these alliances.
And let me just add this. The Apostle Paul has told us what to do. He says, do not be conformed to this world. Here's a good test. Do you spend a great deal of your time worrying about the status of this country? Do you spend a lot of time thinking about how terrible things are? If that's the case, I encourage you to think strongly about this verse. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. That's how we stay resolute. And that's how we stay unswerving. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faced the raging beast. They knew their life was in danger. But do you notice the calmness with which they approach that? It's because of their resoluteness that I'm sticking with God no matter what. I trust Him. And even if they had died a fiery death, they knew that after that pain, there would be a paradise waiting for them. And because of that, they stood up to that king. Fortunately, the beast is not raging in this country. You and I have the door wide open back here. We don't have to worry about somebody coming in and telling us to quit what we're doing. We don't have to be concerned about government officials or soldiers showing up. But what if they did? What would we do? I hope, like these three young men in Babylon, we would stay faithful. Consider that from the standpoint of what we have. You and I need to give thanks, even as we've done tonight, for the freedom that God has given us. It is a precious thing to be able to have the kind of freedom that you and I have. To be here, to study, to evangelize, that is a gift from God. And I hope it continues as long as this nation lasts. But we got to be ready in case it goes away. What if those things take place? We need to be prepared. How do we do that? God tells us. Listen to just a sampling of passages here. First of all, from Paul's writing to Timothy when he says, I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that he is able to guard until that day what had been entrusted to me. Do you and I have that confidence? Think about what the Lord said to the churches and the various ones in Revelation. Just to give a sampling of passages we're going to read together. Do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. But then let's look at the negative. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolatry, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Cowards are the first in line for the second death. You ever notice that? People who swerve. People who say, I'll be strong, but when the heat's turned on, they go the other way. So within this, we see the two sides, and we see where we will stand. That's what God wants us to know. And so as we consider these three young men, and as we consider where we are or where we may be, the important thing to remember is God is in control. Even when it doesn't look like it, God is in control. There is not a promise that we will not go through pain. There is not a promise that you and I will never lose our freedom for standing up for Christ. There most definitely is that possibility. But what you and I need to be doing now is making sure that we are resolved to stand firm whatever happens in this earth. Because we know in the life to come, there will be a place where we'll live, where that kind of thing will never again invade. But you know the only people who are going to be there? The tough ones. The seasoned ones. The ones who stood up and said, I am going to serve God, come what may. And I want to be a part of that number. And I'm convinced you did too. Thank you so much. You've listened so well to every sermon, and I appreciate that again this evening. As I've said, an invitation is not for the purpose of teaching what to do for salvation. An invitation's purpose is basically giving the opportunity for somebody who knows, yet has not yet become a Christian. Tonight, if you're ready to put on Jesus Christ, to die with Him in the waters of baptism, to be raised up, resolute and unswerving, God says, I'm ready to have you on my side. Or perhaps you're facing a moment of weakness, or maybe a life of weakness. If we can pray with you about that this evening, we will. Whatever it takes, let's make sure we leave this building tonight ready to stand for God, come what may. If you need to respond, you can come now as we sing this final song.